From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. It's always great to have a guest return, and this time my guest is Ridley Scott, who's been making films for 30 years now with The Duelist, released 30 years ago. His newest film, of course, is American Gangster. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you for asking.
Do you look back at The Duelist at all? When's the last time you saw it?
I do. Because of technology today, one is constantly asked to upgrade old prints. I'll always keep my eye on the quality of everything I've done before. It's very important. And what we've discovered is that digital is fading quicker than photochem.
Is that true?
Yeah. So suddenly those discs that you think are forever, they're not. And they, in fact, after 10 years, they tend to, you run it. If you've had a disc for 10 years and you run it, and you think, my God, it's not quite as rich as I thought it was when I remembered it. The blacks were blacker and, you know, the contrast was greater, and it's fading. And I found this out because I've been doing 25th anniversary of Blade Runner. But there's going to be there's a five-disc box, which covers every version and your mother, but actually it's very interesting. And we discovered from the old negative we dug out of the cans and did a print. The old negative is pretty damn good after 25 years. And all I had to do was adjust the blacks a little bit, you know. The range had gone. The range was flattening a little bit. Other than that, beautiful. The disc that was done, the only disc that Blade Runner was done, which was like 12, 15 years ago, was not very good, was fading.
Oh, my gosh, because...
That was Criterion, I think. I don't know.
It was a Criterion, sure. The director's cut of the Criterion, sure. Which was on Laserdisc. Because I remember seeing... I actually lived in a city that was a test market, so I got to see Blade Runner theatrically without the narration. Mm-hmm. And I was always fascinated about that addition of the narration and that footage at the end as they leave the city, about your feelings. And you talked about this a little bit before, certainly. Your loyalty to the original version of the film that didn't have that happy ending.
Well, the happy ending came from we'd tested the film, and the film hadn't played very well, confusingly, certainly enough to be worrying. And the general opinion, consensus was it was dark and it was depressing and it was oppressive. And the ending when she walks off into the elevator and he follows her seemed to be unresolved. And what I always thought was a perfect ending, which was for a film noir, right? Was a perfect ending.
It's out of the past.
Yes, and I knew Stanley Kubrick, and I knew Stanley had actually done a lot of shooting for Shining, and he'd been in Montana, so I'd called him and said, I need only your quality of footage of somewhere as a getaway, mountain ranges, somewhere beyond the city, and I know you've probably got weeks of stuff that you shot for The Shining. And he said, I do. And I said, can I look at some of it? Because I want to cut in the movie for a next preview. And he said, no problem. So he sent me around about 20 hours of helicopter footage. And that's how it ended up. It ended up in the movie. And because that ending, I can't remember whether it tested that much better or not. But
I can't imagine that it did, to be honest with you.
But we did it. And it ended up staying in the movie. And Stanley said, as long as you don't use the shot that I used. So he's great. He was great. He's very relaxed about it.
Were you?
No, well, at the time, no, I was kind of disgruntled at the time. And I figured, you know, once you go down the route of, it's double-edged sword. Once you go down the route of previewing, you're suddenly selling your, it's a little extreme thing to say, but you're selling your soul to the devil because you're suddenly starting to listen to other opinions. And that's really not what it's about, particularly a film like that. Blade Runner is particularly a film noir, almost novella.
But it's also not a film that's meant to be seen once.
Yeah. And it's, yes, exactly. You're meant to see this, take it off the shelf and watch it several times, many times. So in a funny kind of way, there's an authorship to this kind of film as opposed to ephemeral movie. You see the difference. And I figured... I'd authored something that was worthwhile, you know. And then because it didn't play, I got twitchy and I started to agree to try things out, you know, like voiceovers and things like that. And it all went the wrong way. And now what we've got is right back to where it should have been.
Because I just remember when I started getting the narration, I just sort of thought,
yeah,
this stuff doesn't need to be explained. Because it was, and maybe it was just my preference, having seen that original version, but it wasn't designed to have these kinds of...
Well, you know, way back when we started out with Hampton Fancher, the idea of narration, we talked about it before the film was made, because Apocalypse Now had worked very successfully with narration. And in fact, Apocalypse Now without narration wouldn't have worked. Martin Sheen's voice was particularly good at internalizing those thoughts. And so I thought, well, maybe there is a possibility. And we could never nail it. We couldn't nail it. Because, you know, on the one hand, and it's you can't say it's horses for courses. You can't apply, you can apply a voice over to a war film that's nearly documentary, but to apply a voiceover to explain dramatic movements and explain what city speak was and explain who Terrell was, it doesn't work. It's clunky. So we never got the voiceover written right. And because of that, Harrison tried. We really tried to make it work. I mean, we didn't go in that disgruntled thinking, screw it, you know, I don't want to do this, so I'm going to do it badly. We really tried.
Because I always found for me, and tell me if you think this is it too, that the narration gets in the way of the emotional content of the movie.
Oddly, it does. It takes you out of the movie. And whereas Martin Sheen's voice in Apocalypse takes you, sucks you into the movie.
It's a clarifying device.
But he could talk about slang, about who Charlie was the first time we heard those expressions.
And he's talking about things that we're not seeing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
By the way, it's a treat, I guess, of director Ridley Scott. We're talking about his career. We'll get to American Gangster eventually. But for me, I think of you as being a filmmaker who moves from era to era with more ease than anybody making movies. And you're not just specifically interested in the contemporary. I mean, you certainly sort of use, and you often use movies that are set in periods, be it the present or the future, as a way to look at the present. And I wonder when that started to make sense for you, or is it something you're still kind of working out in some way?
No, it's working it out. But it's also to do with, you know, whatever the period. If you're doing a period film, which is 18th century, you know, the fundamentals of people and characters don't change that much, just the wardrobe does. The streets may be a bit dirtier or a bit cleaner.
But see, I always thought the Duelist, the difference was that Keith Carradine was the modern and Harvey Keitel was the traditional, the old-fashioned, and it was about the death of that.
Other way around. Harvey Keitel, Napoleon Bonaparte believed in every foot soldier's kit bag was a general's baton. So Harvey Keitel represented the new guard in that he was working class. Keith Carradine represented the old guard, i.e. royalty, royal family, in that Napoleon Bonaparte realized very quickly he could not have an army only of new guard. He needed a mix of both. So smartly, he reintroduced a lot of the aristocracy back into the army because he knew he needed them.
But that class and that thing seems to me to be specifically British and very much a part of what you do. Class distinctions are in all of your films. I mean, or certainly perceptions of class and perceptions of social status. It's a big part of American Gangster, too.
Oh, yeah, that's very much so. In that I'm explaining or, you know, evolving the universe of two characters that won't meet till 12 minutes from the end of the movie, who, and what I, my job is to make those two universes dynamically fascinating enough to engage you for 2 hours and 15 minutes before they get together. And with the view to there is an inevitability that Frank Lucas will fall finally, and that Richie Roberts will find him, will identify who this person is who's peddling heroin in such a grand manner, like a king in Harlem, out of Harlem. He doesn't even know it's out of Harlem. He thinks it could be the Spanish, South Americans, could be mafia. He doesn't know. He can't put his finger on whoever that may be. And so my job is to keep those two universes really interesting. And so you can argue when you're looking at it in paper form, when it's being written, do we need Richie's family life and the two divorce scenes? Do we really need to see Richie, what he does at home? Do we need to have Richie applying to, you know, to become a prosecutor or a defense attorney, when really it's a cop movie, it's a cop and robber movie. And I said, on the contrary, you have to have these things so that each character is independent. His universe is enough to engage you. So when I go to Richie's universe, it's either about him doing his cop work, trying to track down who this Frank Lucas is, or he has other problems in his life. He has a end of a marriage. His private life is, let's describe it as immature, dysfunctional, immature, right? And atypical, by the way, probably for a cop at that point. And the other one, his universe is built on care, attention, great work ethic, very close to his family, very close to his mother. And yet what he does, he's the purveyor and peddler, the biggest ever, of heroin, where he's had the gall to fly to Vietnam, pay off pilots, helicopter pilots, and long-distance pilots to bring back heroin in body bags and coffins.
He's dealing with the market, but it also it's very much kind of class route to me. And I just wonder if there were movies that fascinate you, if the part of the way that the French New Wave shattered sort of differences between class or asked questions about those movies.
I was very excited by Breathless at the time. I was very excited about, when I was a student, Kitchen Sink Cinema in the UK, Tony Richardson.
Look Back in Anger, all
John
those kinds
Schlesinger,
of films. Sure, yeah.
The guy who did This Sporting Life. Lindsay Anderson. Taste of Honey, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, If. There's all kind of social, working class movie making.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is filmmaker Ridley Scott. His new film is American Gangster. But that kind of working class ethos to me is very much a part of the films you've made. Sure. There's always a character that represents that. I mean, we look at a Blade Runner or Someone to Watch Over Me, Gladiator even, I think. I just wondered for you if that was ever a conscious thing, or is it just part of who you are?
No, part of who I am. In that it's always looking for the step up, someone's stepping upwards.
But it even leads to a big schism in Alien. I mean, it's very much the working class versus...
We go below decks in Alien.
Yeah.
And Harry Dean and Yaphet Kotto saying, it's all about you, you got no personality, they don't want to come down here.
But that's incredible to me. And even the worlds of Philip K. Dick in Blade Runner are about the upper class versus the lower class. I mean, those who are stuck on Earth, stuck on the ground.
Well, I figured there's going to be maybe three companies going to run the world anyway. It's heading that way. So Terrell Corporation, one of those companies. The company becomes so large, it becomes more powerful than the government.
It really is that. And that's... And there's also this interesting sort of battle against traditional structure that's a big part of your films, too. And that must attract you to a lot of the material that you do.
Yeah, I mean, I don't quite know. I mean, we do a lot of development, and sometimes not necessarily for me. So what I have in development nearly always is something very specifically that I might make. I'll direct myself. And sometimes if I don't end up directing, we'll try and produce it. And there's offshoot score from that into TV in the last year. I've got this show called Numbers on a Friday. We did a very successful thing called The Company, which is about the CIA. Then we just finished Churchill 2 with Brendan Gleeson playing Churchill, Winston Churchill, in the war years. Remake of Andromeda Strain.
Wow.
And pitching for other shows. So it's all about writing.
We'll take a break and talk more about that with Ridley Scott. His new film is American Gangster. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest, Ridley Scott, is celebrating 30 years of filmmaking this year and the 25th anniversary of one of the most influential films of the past 30 years, actually, Blade Runner. His new film is American Gangster. We were talking before about a kind of drama that given the scale of your movie, you often make stuff that we can consider to be epic. I mean, just the use of the framing, the master shot being so key, the way you make films and the way you move people through that, that there's still a kind of a – I think there's being kind of close to the ground because of that working class environment, which you were saying before, that's something you kind of became cognizant of when you were in art school a little bit? Or
art school was everything for me. Because my formal education was a bit of a disaster.
How do you mean?
I wasn't, I'm not receptive. I'm almost, I think later the word becomes fashionable. It was dyslexic. I cannot absorb anything that I'm not interested in. And my father was always very good, nice gentleman, He would just weary look at my school report and say, well, you can only do the best you can. Okay, oh my God. And that made me try really hard. And I was given advice to leave the school by an art master who said, listen, where are you going with this? He said, you're going to stay on this grammar school. You hate it, don't you? I said, yeah. He said, go to art school. I'll get you fixed at one of two art schools. And I did. I went to art school and I adored it. And I spent the next 7 years at art school.
When did you start drawing?
Oh, 5 years old. I could really draw, really, really draw, really paint. And by the time I was 12, I was doing painting every weekend. And so I could do that, and that's what my father said, agreed. He said, you should go to art school. I went to art school in the north of England for 3 years, and then I was pretty good, and I got some very good passes, and I got into the Royal College of Art, which is the best one to go to. Everything just changed. I went to art school, everything adjusted. Which is always, that creative process is very interesting. You've got kids, a kid who was, I wasn't dysfunctional and I was trying, but I just wasn't interested.
This wasn't your affinity.
I'm just bored with seeing this. Why am I doing Latin? And then the Royal College was fearsomely competitive because it's hard to get in, very difficult, very few intake every on a yearly basis. It's a bit like getting to Oxford or Cambridge or Harvard. And of art schools. And I then spent the next 3-4 years there. And at the end of it would come out as a designer for BBC. I'd be designing sets. So I figured I have stepped closer to the possibility of actually making movies.
And that was a great time to be there because the BBC were doing lots of great dramas in those days.
Yeah. I was designing huge dramas, big dramas with 6 cameras. And I was doing big sets and things like that. It was kind of cool. And I learned about bureaucracy, budgeting, how to run a budget, how to deal with red tape and all that stuff. And I was doing good, and so I was given a director's course. And suddenly I was thrown in with all the people I couldn't deal with before. I was thrown in with academics who were coming from Oxford and Cambridge, who are mainly the prime functionaries for what they call the Commonwealth Television. So you get a guy who'd been to Oxford or Cambridge from Nigeria would come in and he'd be trained in producing, directing courses because he'd be sent, go back home to Nigeria, set up a TV station. They gave me a show from my experience in this so-called TV school at BBC. They said, do you want to do a TV show? And I said, yeah. So suddenly I was directing live TV. So that was really cool. So I was applying art to TV, everything I learned in art to television. So my TV was pretty good. And I started to move fast in there. And then advertising found out that I was a director who had a kind of bit of an eye. So they offered me television commercials. So suddenly I was moonlighting doing TV commercials when I was working at BBC. And it became about money because I was earning more in a day than I was earning a month in BBC. So I thought there's something wrong with this picture here. I think I'm going to go and do TV commercials. And I was in there for the next 2,000 commercials in 22 years where I was suddenly able to pay for my own screenplays.
Not a bad way to go. It's Ridley Scott is my guess. It's the treatment we're talking about. His career, which happens to include the new film American Gangster. We talked about this the last time you were here, and you really let me back to it, which is that way that period of British filmmakers that you were part of that got their starts on television but worked in commercials and create a visual language changed the face of filmmaking.
Yeah, it did, for sure. Because you start off with, go back again, you start off with Dick Lester, Dick Lester with the Beatles films, Hard Day's Night and all that kind of thing. Dick had actually started off a kind of visual language he brought out of television commercials. But he was never the commercial maker that I was. My competitors at that moment were Alan Parker, Adrian Lyne.
That graphic vitality of the kind of stuff, first of all...
It was aggressive. It was an aggressive form of cutting, and suddenly you weren't shooting, seeing footsteps go up the stairs, hand goes to handle, turns the knob, comes in the room, and everything is shown. You're doing little quantum jumps in terms of just pure communication. Because of that, it's more assertive and it's more aggressive. And so people are really paying attention. So,
but there's also a real trust in the audience that the audience will make those leaps with you,
well,
right?
Well, I think the commercials, there was a time where commercials were, honestly, you'd look forward to the commercial break because the commercials were pretty damn good and were, Alan was would always do really brilliantly. He was a writer. Alan Parker was a very, very good copywriter. Probably one of the best ever to emerge out of
the industry. He started in writing. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, he's a copywriter. And so Alan was directing commercials of his own written commercials for a very creative agency when he was already, like, he was 25. I started my own company when I was 27. And I was all visually oriented, and he was all dialogue and actor oriented. And Adrian Lyne kind of was in the middle. And honestly, if I was going to really melt it down, that was the three. Then there was all the rest. I'm really being ruthless here, but that's the truth. And I always remember sitting on, they would have on Monday mornings, Monday morning newcomers, and I'd always sit there with a cup of coffee and lots of cigarettes in those days, press the button, watch Monday morning newcomers. And it was like, oh, God, who did that? Oh, damn, look at that. Damn Adrian, he's so good, you know? Because his stuff would be coming up, oh, Parker, oh, bugger Parker, there he goes again. And it was very competitive. It was great, healthy competition, creative competition. It was fabulous. And there was lots of other, there's about 250 other commercial makers, but I think we were kind of driving the bus.
Let me ask you an American gangster question, though, because it's a style of filmmaking that actually is very different from what you've done before. I mean, it's much more leisurely. It's also, the look of it could be, it could be a 70s film. It could be one of those films that, you know, you weren't inspired by it. One of those films that you kind of left in the dust. It could be an Arthur Penn film or Sidney Lumet movie from the early 70s.
Was it Robert Frank, the photographer, great American photographer?
Yes.
Frank, William Klein, Fashion on the Streets.
Yes.
William Klein, Willie Klein. I went for that, went a lot of that, and went 185 and didn't go widescreen. So 185 already started, looks like a still photograph. So it's not 166, which is nearly square, but it's getting there. And I'd had a lot of experience in Morocco and New York at that particular point, coming through college, traveling scholarship here. I spent a year in New York. I worked with Don Pennybeck and Richard Leacock at a company called Bob Drew Associates. My first job from my traveler wasn't as a designer. I went and knocked on the door of Richard Leacock and Don Pennybeck and asked them for a job. And they gave me a job, 7 years of art school, first class honors, traveling scholarship. And I'm making coffee and getting hamburgers for the editor in the editing room. And that's fine. That was great. And I did that for a year. And then I elevated, they gave me a Nagra, beginning of the Nagra. I'd sit in the back of the theater and listen to Don Pennybaker or Leacock say, okay, take 16 sets of Jack Kennedy looks okay, a little out of focus. And I'd say, Bob says, and I'd relay this onto a tape, which is then transcribed. We'd log millions of feet on 16 mil because they'd just discovered crystal sink. You got no wire. You got crystal sink in the Niagara. I was always driving down to Brooklyn in the back of a taxi with two Niagaras that had broken down, taken to the guy who's invented it in his little workshop with millions of radios and parts and dust and things. I'd take these Niagaras and he'd fiddle with a screw around and say, okay, it's fixed.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is filmmaker Ridley Scott. His new film is American Gangster. Getting a chance to make films or to work with these guys who were changing documentary film at the time.
That gave me a little bit of information. So I went back to England and I'd started a half-hour movie when I was at the Royal College with a Bolex, with a clockwork camera. And this is called Boy in a Bicycle. And that's now on the DVD for Duelists.
Yes.
So that's my brother. That's my brother Tony. I'd be 20... He'd be 14. And I'd made it for £65. No, so when I came back, the British Film Institute had seen it and said, we like this. We will give you another £200 to go up and pick up any shots you need and finish and mix it. So I got £200, and that's exactly what I did. I finished it and mixed it. And that later would help me get onto the BBC directing course, because I was a designer, but I was always knocking on the doors and applying for the new departments that were evolving at this moment in terms of BBC and its history. And we were suddenly coming with Channel 2 and Channel 3. And so I was trying to get in as a director. Have you done any film before? Have you done any directing before? Yeah. And I'd run the 16mm film for them.
My God, when you think about that period too, I mean, that's you think about the people who were writing and directing in that time, the BBC.
Sure. John McGrath, people like John McGrath.
Ken Russell, sure.
Ken Russell, Ken Loach, Peter Watkins. And that was the department I was desperate to get into. It was functioning out of Ealing. And I couldn't get in there because I was kind of stuck departmentalized in the design side. But the design side was so exciting. It's funny, you know, I never questioned that I wouldn't get there.
Really?
Never.
Even though you were running into that kind of bureaucratic
wall. I was going
opposite
direction at certain points, but I always figured I'd get there. I was always knocking on the door. It's just something that was a real nuisance.
And what was the final knock that got the door open for you?
Well, it was actually, I think, enormous success as a commercial film company. So then we opened in Paris and then New York, and that became a complete sidetrack, because when you're enjoying yourself and being successful, you don't question it. And I was 38 thinking, God, I haven't done a movie yet. I got to make a movie. And so I started to write. I wrote two scripts and it got as far as getting them cast, budgeted, and right on the edge of getting made. And then one was actually, funnily enough, called Ronnie and Leo, which I'd written for Michael York and Ernest Borgnine. It was an original idea about heist, buddy-buddy movie, which I thought would always have been pretty good. And then I did, that didn't happen for whatever reason, but I got close.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd wrote this thing, got paid to write a screenplay for the Bee Gees, which is pretty interesting, pretty cool. And a friend and I wrote this script called Castle X, and suddenly I was standing in Yugoslavia. I'm going to make the film with the Bee Gees. With no singing, they're all going to act. And then something happened, so that flatlined because he pulled the money. And I was standing with my ticket in Yugoslavia at the airport on my way home. Then I thought, this is ridiculous. I am earning enough money to pay for a good writer to write a screenplay. The upshot was I finally got a screenplay written by Jerry Vaughan Hughes called The Duelists. That was off. Then I was off and running.
And we're off and running, so out of time. Can you come back in less than another 2 years to talk more?
Sure.
My guest is Ridley Scott. His new film is American Gangster. Our technical director and editor is Mario Diaz, with assistance from Paul Ruiz at Argo Network in New York. Gemma Dempsey is the producer. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.